Thank you, Paul Weyrich. Paul has agreed to meet with any group after the session is over to disclose how you identify a new dealer. I think he looks a little bit like Ted Kennedy. Our next speaker is A. Lawrence, or Laurie Chickering, who grew up in San Francisco, graduated from Stanford and Yale Law School, practiced law briefly in San Francisco, moved to New York to become assistant to the editor of National Review, and from then on it was up. In 1970, he returned to California to become general counsel and director of research for the California State Office of Economic Opportunity. In 1974, he was the founder and the first executive director of the Institute for Contemporary Studies, where he still is. During that time, he has organized and edited more than 25 Institute books on subjects ranging from U.S. foreign and defense policy and the international economy to domestic issues of Social Security, national health insurance, government regulation, and business. I don't know how old he is. I give you Laurie Chickering. 41.
Thank you, Arnold. I don't know much about the internal politics on the social agenda. My sense, following Paul's remarks, is that it's going nowhere. And I think the question is, that I'd like to address myself, is whether it should go anywhere, or whether the whole idea, the whole enterprise of a social agenda is fundamentally misguided, and whether we shouldn't do something quite different. It's a very difficult subject for several reasons. Arnold revealed one of them over breakfast when we were talking about the session, and he said, what is the social agenda anyway? And I think that is a very fundamental problem, because I think when people talk about the social agenda, maybe to a group like this, it's like a code phrase, which everybody knows what it is. But the fact is, if you look down the list of things that get subsumed under the category, it takes you in a lot of different directions. In some directions, it takes you into areas where libertarians and traditionalists are each other's throats. Other areas, there are surprising allegiances and alliances on various subjects. I'm not going to try and untangle all of the different tributaries and places thinking about these issues led me in the last couple of days, but I would like to say a few things about some underlying philosophical issues, which will reveal a lot about the tension which is very rarely aired in public between libertarians and traditionalists, and may, I hope, reveal something about problems we have communicating with the left, and may also suggest, in untangling the relationship between the two, suggest some things we might do which might make us more effective than I think we are much of the time. In general, the social agenda, very broadly, I think, is taken to mean the agenda of the new right and its commitment to government programs which involve legislating in areas of moral behavior. Now, there are a lot of exceptions to this, so I take it as a very crude generalization, but the categories, Arnold mentioned them, involve things like drugs, homosexuality, school prayers, draft, abortion, pornography. But on some issues, a couple of issues notably, tuition tax credits and gun control, libertarians and traditionalists' attitudes intersect in very interesting ways. The essential traditionalist commitment to these issues is based on desire to restore concepts of traditional authority, which seem to have been lost, and the essential emphasis is focused on communities and groups. After all, the phrase is social agenda. On groups, and therefore there is an emphasis on civic responsibility in relation to the draft, civic education, and things like that. I think the other reason why this issue is so difficult, and this is really, it seems odd in a way, all of the meetings one goes to, that something that carries such intense passion among the disputants on each side gets aired publicly, even at private meetings like this, so rarely, it seems extremely odd to me, is the extent to which the social agenda defines the point of bitterest conflict between libertarians and traditionalists. So bitter, in fact, that the descriptions, the things that one side says about the other in respect of these issues are hardly printable. And yet meetings like this occur, people go for days and hardly mention this. I know that the need for hunkering down, for staying united on the issues that unite us, the opposition to government control of various things, and the commitment to markets for the most part, though even the new right deviates on that, may provide a reason for most of the discussions at these meetings. But it seems really odd to me that there is no, I'm about to do that, by the way, I'm about to address this rather directly. In viewing the social agenda, for each traditionalist concern about virtue and order, there is an opposite traditional libertarian concern about freedom, about keeping the government out. And in fact, many of the freedoms which the libertarians promote involve freedoms to defy the order the traditionalists want. And that really, in a sense, defines libertarians' position on many of these issues. The libertarian social agenda involves opposition to the draft, as well as opposition to restrict what they regard as private moral behavior in homosexuality, drugs, abortion, and so on. Again, for sake of time, it's a crude thing because the question of what's private we can get into, but I don't want to get into it here. Also, for traditionalists, in the area of education is one area which is interesting because they do correspond. The social agenda for libertarians involves school vouchers, increasing individual choice. And the same seems to be true of traditionalists, with an emphasis on getting away from government control. On school prayers, the traditionalist commitment is to allow school prayers to encourage more morality and virtue. The libertarian position is really based more on free choice. It's based on asking the question quite rightly, why should we have a system in which only the rich can pray in school? In short, the interesting thing about libertarians and traditionalists, because their positions are so utterly divided on many of these issues, is to how to find, they seem in such absolute conflict that it's very hard to see how one could find common ground between. One is committed to order, community, and gradual change, the other to freedom, individualism, and often compulsive change. And the problem of finding common ground between the commitment of one to modernist values of reason, individualism, and progress, and the others who diagnose the modern torment as precisely an invasion by those same values, liberal libertarian values, on the pre-modern virtues, how does one go about reconciling those? It's hard to think how you could increase the differences. But if you look closer, there is the key there, I think, to filling in many gaps in the current dialogue on a whole series of issues, particularly in the difficulties people at meetings like this have communicating with the left. Let me say a quick thing about the politics. I think it's possible, whenever you're talking about politics, to cite individual races and say where, if you had just done something differently in a particular race, it would have gone the other way, or the particular race went one way because something was done, and if you hadn't done it, it would have been defeated. I think that if you look at an aggregated picture across all races in general, it's hard to forget Kevin Phillips' book, The Emerging Republican Majority, which really was written at the end of the 60s, on the idea that the Republican Party would become the majority party largely on the social agenda. And it never happened, and I think it didn't happen for reasons William Schneider outlines at much greater length than I can treat here in the book that the Institute for Contemporary Studies did on American politics, that the blue-collar workers, the lower middle class, are conservative on social issues, but the economic, more traditional concerns override the social issues whenever there's any distress over them. The problem, I think there's a second intrinsic reason why Reagan administration that never presses up social issues, and that is that the Reagan administration is too conservative. And the reason I say that is that this issue highlights two conflicting conservative commitments. One to certain substantive outcomes, morality and virtue and so on, and the other to the instrumental commitment to stability, moderation, and compromise. The great problem is that those two commitments are in absolute conflict when you're in office. If you're out of office, you don't worry about compromising and so on, you keep up the pressure. When you're in office, you have to be concerned about that because what you do affects everything else you do, and for a whole variety of reasons. The fact is that compromise is not possible on many of the social issues, on abortion, on drugs, on homosexuality, on the draft. And therefore, there is tremendous social instability built into strong positions on them. Now, here, I think, the conflict between conservatives and liberals is, I'm going to say it right, straight out, is asymmetric. Because conservatives are forced to pay maybe what some might regard as a prohibitive price for their commitment to order. And the price is that they are forced to yield to the substantive outcomes defined by the other side, which places no such emphasis on order. But many conservatives, and I think many of Paul's constituents, apart from people in activist groups who are substantive conservatives on these issues, are also temperamentally conservative. And I think they would have a deep fear of the convulsive change and so forth that would be involved with putting in place many of the items on the social agenda which we're discussing. Let me now pull back from the thing and look at it in terms of underlying issues, and look at these issues in terms broadly of libertarians and traditionalists. I want to say that I half agree with everything Paul Weyrich believes on these issues. And I think if David Friedman were here, I would say that I half agree with everything David Friedman says. And I think that that each half is terribly important. And it's in combination that you can say something very interesting about these issues, but that neither half by itself accomplishes very much. It's on order. And it does both socially, in terms of societies as a whole, and individually. I'm now inwardly in each individual. Socially as a whole, if chaos reigns, no one will tolerate that, and people will insist that order be imposed. So freedom depends on the consensual order, which makes free institutions possible. Individually, because for reasons that Burke said, as well as anyone, that society cannot exist unless a controlling power upon will and appetite be placed somewhere, and the less of it there is within, the more there is without. The point here is that identity, that which we think about ourselves, is a concept of order. It's a concept of where are we, what's the source of order. It'll have to add up to unity, and the less you have within, in terms of structure, in terms of purpose, in terms of identity, the more you will insist be imposed from without. That explains, I suggest, all of the reasons for the opposition to a liberal society expressed by both intellectuals and the young, who are without a strong sense of inner order. Ernest Vandenhoff gave a magnificent talk on this subject at the Pumpkin Papers Dinner in New York, actually, the appeal of communism and of the crypto-religious beliefs for many intellectuals. Because lacking a sense of inner order, they sought the imposition of order from without. And therefore, in a certain sense, the threat to freedom from the lack of order comes from those who are furthest removed from the traditional sources of order, family, church, and local community, and so on. If you keep yourself fixed on the problem of order, it has interesting implications for thinking about the differences between the USSR and the United States. But mostly people think of it as a society based on freedom versus totalitarianism. But I think a much more constructive way to look at it is as two societies who are in conflict over competing principles of order. If order is the problem, the essential problem, the key is authority. And the important thing is to distinguish authority from coercive power. And coercive power, you can impose things on people. They do that in the Soviet Union. There's no authority there. The key to authority is consent. It's only strong when people consent to it. And the great problem we face, I think, as a society today is that increasingly people are demanding the right to make free choices about their moral commitments. And I think this identifies the weakness in the new rights position on the social agenda. The government cannot impose order. It cannot recapture the loss of traditional authority which we had in the past. The only way a source of order can emerge, which will replace the older sources, is to understand the increasing need of people to make free choices. And that's the libertarian side of the argument. And that's the libertarian side is critical to understanding the dilemma we face today, I think. If you look at the increasing need to choose, you can look at it negatively, as a traditionalist might, and say, well, choosing just means you want to rebel. But positively, from a moral and spiritual point of view, conceptually, you can't have morality without free choice. And that without freedom, morality is impossible. And therefore, people who want virtue have to be for freedom. There's a very important substantive problem here, too. So anyway, I think the right way to view the social agenda requires a concern for both things, for both the substantive commitment of traditionalists to morality and order, and the instrumental commitment of libertarians to free choice. Each, I think, as I say, has a blurred position, but if you put them together, if you put slides one behind the other, you get a clear picture on the screen. The great problem for, I think, people in our position is that nobody, I think it's not an exaggeration to say, absolutely nobody is attempting to combine this concern for free choice and a concern for what constitutes the good life. Peter Berger, in a sense, wrote a book which embodies this concern in his book entitled The Heretical Imperative. And the word heresy may upset traditionalists, but the word heresy in the sense in which he meant it comes from the Greek word to choose. That is the essential burden. That is, whether we like it or not, more and more people have to choose. And if you have kids who are now entering adolescence, you're going to see it on a scale that our parents and grandparents never saw. That is a permanent part of life. I think that one of the problems in this is that economists, for the most part, are only concerned with instrumental, value-free systems of freedom. They don't concern themselves with the substantive issues. And the people who do concern themselves with substantive issues ignore the importance of free choice and create all kinds of schemes for imposing virtue and freedom on people, which won't work. So who is exploring this fusion between freedom and order? Well, unfortunately, I think most of it is going on the left. And I think that it's going on in extremely imperfectly. Most of the expressions of freedom, the exploration of freedom on the left, involves exploring freedom from traditional authority, from moving away from it in every area in which they're interested in freedom. And they're all interested very strongly in concepts of order and virtue, which are all crypto-religious, whether the old left with the centralized, unitary, soulless, scientific socialism and all that stuff, which seems so shot from guns now, and the new left's more explicitly fundamentalist return to order and virtue, and the inherent sinfulness of man and the coming damnation and all of the stuff that goes with the extreme environmentalism. On the positive side from the left, however, there are very serious explorations about how to restore personal responsibility to people. And there's nobody in the room who would be better situated to talk about this than Frank Gogel, I don't know where he is, who is the principal expositor of Abraham Maslow in this country. But the whole of the third four psychologists, in a way, exist to get away from the deterministic strains of psychology in Freudianism and behaviorism. People like Maslow and Carl Rogers and Gordon Allport and Roberto Assagioli have tremendous followings on the left, and the reason is because they're all exploring avenues to personal responsibility using free choice. Well, I think that I will just end by saying I think that the social agenda as government action is misguided, that it represents a failure to understand both the pragmatic and the substantive moral and spiritual significance and importance of free choice, and that the importance of the social agenda for us is to understand how the libertarians and traditionalists could come together and make a demonstration, which we're not now making, and greatly broaden our appeal. The real burden, I think, now is to denationalize the social agenda and to emphasize all of those virtues in private, consensual ways. I think that once we begin that in a serious way, we will have begun to meet the threat to free institutions for the first time.